Welcome to Political Rewind. I'm Bradley George, filling in today for Bill Nye. Got a shorter edition of the program on this Friday. We're joined by Jim Galloway from the Atlanta Journal-Constitution. Also joining us, Christina Torres from the AJC. Christina,
good,
glad to see you. And from Washington, another AJC reporter. This is Tamar Holloman. Tamar, thanks for being here as well.
Thanks for having me.
And lots to talk about, as always. We're first going to start, though, with the threat of Hurricane Irma and how the state of Georgia is preparing to respond to it. And Governor Nathan Deal outlined some of that response in a press conference this morning.
I want to caution all Georgians that just because the weather now may appear to be calm, do not take that for granted. This is a rapidly moving hurricane, and the weather and the consequences of that hurricane can change dramatically within a relatively short period of time. I would urge everyone, be cautious. This is a dangerous hurricane. The aftermaths of the hurricane will probably be significant, and we will work as rapidly as possible to put people back in as near a normal setting as can be done as quickly as possible after the danger has subsided.
It's been almost a year since Georgia was hit by a hurricane, Hurricane Matthew, in October of 2016. Jim Galloway, what's changed in the state's response emergency management?
Well, the big thing is that we've got Homer Bryson new in the post. Matthew came through, and if I'm not mistaken, it did a little bit of damage on the coast, but not much more than that. But it did. You had an eruption. You had this very, very strange eruption within GEMA management between Jim Butterworth and the guy who ran the operations center, name of Jim Perkins. And immediately after that, Butterworth handed in his resignation, said he was moving off to the private sector, and it took a while to find for a deal to land on Mr. Bryson. But you've also got this mushing together of GEMA and Homeland Security.
That's right.
And so you've got an expanded assignment for them. This is probably the biggest civil defense test that you and I have experienced in our lifetime, I think, that's coming up. And we're in there right now. I mean, I don't know about you, Bradley, but I live in far, far out Cobb County.
Mm-hmm.
And when I drove in here to the studio this afternoon, it was just, the interstate was just packed northbound. It was solid cars and trucks, semis, trailers. It's going to be tough to get around this weekend, never mind Monday when the storm actually hits Metro Atlanta.
Well, if everything happens the way officials want to, Monday probably will actually not be bad because hopefully everyone will be off the
road.
You know, even I was at the state capitol this morning. I covered the press conference and coming up just a short drive up the connector today to get here to the studios in Midtown. You know, maybe I'm looking for them, but there certainly were more Florida tags and out-of-state tags and trailers and things coming up the highway. You know, I know officials are urging people from out of state to go up to North Georgia. They haven't gotten Atlanta accommodations to make room in local shelters closer to the coast and in South Georgia for local residents. And who knows, maybe that's working.
And that's it could be very well Southwest Georgia, not so much the coast.
Exactly. The latest path seems to be more that way than any sort of direct hit on the coast of Georgia.
Tamar Holloman, as far as the federal response is concerned, of course, FEMA faced a major test with Hurricane Harvey for its new administrator, Brock Long. Imagine it's more of the same now with the threat from Irma.
Yeah, the president just declared a state of emergency for Georgia just a few short hours ago. And that's something that a lot of the local politicians based in Georgia were really looking for. That frees up more federal resources to come down preemptively. And I think people are feeling a little bit better after this, but there's still that uncertainty about what's going to come down the road.
And I imagine Congress just passed an aid package for Harvey and could very well be back at some point in the next couple of weeks to do the same for Irma.
I believe tomorrow hasn't the congressional folks from Florida already called for funding to help their state?
Yeah, so the House today just passed a $15 billion package for Harvey, and there's definitely an expectation that more is going to need to come in the months later. So I think everybody's expecting to come back after Irma comes and have to dole out even more money. But the thought was that they needed to get this money out the door earlier than a lot of people thought, just because the burn rate was so fast down in Texas.
And right. And FEMA's funds, I believe they were sort of running a little low on cash, weren't they?
They were supposed to run out of money today. I think they've patched that hole.
Yeah, and initially, you know, Congress didn't have to raise the debt ceiling until the initial projection was the end of the month. And because of Hurricane Harvey and because FEMA had to spend so much money, they had until just about today to get it done. So they really came in under the wire there.
So we're going to talk a little bit more about the debt ceiling deal and how Republicans, especially people in the Georgia delegation, are reacting to that in the next part of the show. Jim, you got something real quick?
Yeah. I've just got a notice from the Secretary of State's office. And this is small, but it's politics, and this is Political Rewind. We've got Brian Kemp's office says that they are going to shift the qualifying period for several special elections for House seats, for vacancies that are out there, like Stacey Abrams' seat.
Yep.
They're going to shift that from Monday through Wednesday. Now it's going to be Wednesday through Friday because of the storm. So in other words, they're expecting the Capitol to be hard to get to and under a lot of stress for Monday and Tuesday.
I can imagine so, yeah. We're talking on this Friday with Jim Galloway and Christina Torres from the AJC and the Atlanta Journal-Constitution's Tamar Halliman joining us from Washington as well. We'll get back to the discussion in a few moments, but we want to remind you that it is your support that makes these discussions and coverage of major situations in Georgia like Hurricane Irma, possible. And we're asking for that. It is our fall fund drive. And here are some folks to tell you how you can do your part to support GPB with a contribution. This is Political Rewind on GPB. I'm not Bill Nigut. I'm Bradley George. Bill is having some issues with his voice. It's rather scratchy. He's kind of hoarse. So hopefully he's at home getting some vocal rest and also staying safe as Hurricane Irma approaches Georgia. We're glad you're with us on this Friday afternoon, and we're joined by Jim Galloway from the Atlanta Journal-Constitution and his AJC colleagues, Christina Torres and Tamar Halliman. So the big news in Washington this week was the deal to raise the debt limit for 3 months and to also pass a package of hurricane relief for victims of Hurricane Harvey, a deal that President Trump cut with Democratic lawmakers and one that left conservative politicians like Senator Ben Sasse of Nebraska feeling a little miffed.
What we're doing in this body today is not draining the swamp. What we're doing is running a whole bunch of hoses to the edge of the swamp, turning them on to the highest possible volume flow, and then turning our backs on the swamp and shouting, there's nothing to see here. That's what we're doing. We're doing the opposite of draining the swamp today. So your constituents know that Chuck Schumer, whose title is minority leader, not majority leader, just made himself the most powerful man in America for the month of December. Chuck Schumer and Nancy Pelosi now have most of the cards for when we get to December. This is an embarrassing moment for a Republican-controlled Congress and a Republican administration.
Jim, the Republicans had the trifecta of government here, and here's President Trump making deals with Democrats.
And when they wouldn't move, Trump knocked on the door of Democrats. It was that was truly amazing. I think 90 House Republicans voted against this deal today,
yeah, including a number from Georgia.
Right. So it's rubbing conservative Republicans the wrong way, but it's kind of interesting. That, you know, well, first of all, for Mr. Sasse, I'm absolutely stunned that he didn't use hurricane storm surge as a metaphor.
if he lived closer to the coast, he might have.
Or Nebraska, not so much.
Yeah.
Tamar, what are you hearing when you're talking with members of Georgia's delegation, GOP members, about what the president did this week?
Sure. I think there's frustration on two levels. On the one hand, I think people are frustrated that Trump cut this deal so quickly. There were a bunch of counteroffers that Republicans were preparing. They knew that Democrats wanted to keep everything on a compressed time frame. And I think there was, you know, they felt a little blindsided that Trump would accept this so quickly. There's also, for the fiscal conservatives in Georgia, there's a frustration that they we're kind of forced into accepting this deal to raise the debt limit to fund the government through the end of December without any sort of spending cuts. This is something that they've pushed for years, and they were always really frustrated under Democratic presidents that they were stuck kind of on the status quo, but they were thinking, we're getting this from a Republican president? But at the same time, every single person I talked to, every single Republican, they took such pains to emphasize, you know, yes, we don't like this deal, but we still love Donald Trump. You know, he still is very powerful in Georgia, still is very influential, and the lawmakers realize that.
And that, yeah, that's the box that Trump has put them in right now. I mean, the thing is, if you went if you look at the latest polls out of Georgia, I'm sure you would find Trump in, you know, maybe in the high 30s, low 40s as far as approval ratings. The problem is that just doesn't tell the story. You have to divide it by party, and once you get into asking Republicans what they think about Trump, it's still high 70s. It's still far too high for a Republican House member to think about rebelling, or even David Perdue. I mean, that was an incredibly long statement that David Perdue put out explaining his vote. Was
exactly.
It not?
Exactly, and he's a guy who's made a name for himself, really. You know, painted himself as Mr. Debt. You know, he always complains about the, you know, what he sees as unchecked levels of spending in Washington. And here's a deal that would, you know, keep Washington going on the same path. But for him, you know, he made the argument that it would be horrible to default on the debt. And for that reason, he was okay with doing a 3-month bill. But because the president accepted this, I think a lot of Republicans felt like they had cover to vote for something that maybe they wouldn't have otherwise voted for.
Hey, Tamar, if I could just, could you help me understand why Ben Sasse says that this puts Chuck Schumer and Nancy Pelosi in control come December?
Absolutely. So what this bill does is that on December 8th, funding for the government is going to be up, and they're going to need to raise the debt ceiling again. Now, on fiscal matters in Washington, there's going to always be a core group of Republicans that will vote no on bills like that. They hate adding to the debt. They will never vote for a spending bill. So that means that Republicans will have to rely on Democrats.
Yeah, they need Democratic votes.
And Democrats know this, and so they're going to ask for something in return. And so I think a lot of Republicans saw this as kind of a Trojan horse, you know, a way for Nancy Pelosi and Chuck Schumer to ask for, I don't know, a DACA deal in December or something else that, you know, Democrats really want. But being in the minority, a lot of the Republicans think they shouldn't be getting.
Well, and meanwhile, you have a president who believes he's art of the deal. He just made a deal, and he's following through on this pledge to shake things up, right?
Yeah.
He doesn't think McConnell has high energy. He's too low energy, and he's not happy with him. And never mind Paul Ryan. This sends certainly a signal.
Yeah, absolutely. There's definitely been a lot of kind of quiet animosity between Trump and the two Republican leaders on Capitol Hill. It was just amazing how quickly he struck a deal with these two Democratic leaders who, in the past, he hasn't been so nice to.
Yeah, and it kind of underlines the great worry that Republicans have had about Donald Trump, that he's
a secret Democrat.
That he doesn't have an ideology at all.
Right,
it's just
right.
About making the deal.
Well, it's interesting. I have a quote here from, this was in the Washington Post. This is Senator Chris Murphy, Democrat of Connecticut. He says, there aren't any permanent alliances. There aren't any governing philosophies. There's day by day seat of the pants management. That's how he describes the climate.
Well, and I think the other idea is this deal doesn't hurt him at the base, right? Which goes back to why
there are
those that will support him in the Republican Party to say, okay, we can swallow this. It's fine. You know, Charlottesville certainly didn't hurt. There are other decisions that you could argue might be worse that didn't hurt. This is a congressional deal for, you know, no one's going to blink.
Right. No. And that's what makes this so amazing, that Trump has more maneuverability when it comes to dealing with Democrats than Paul Ryan or Mitch McConnell does. Neither of them can reach across the aisle. It is just politically impossible for them to do.
At some point, does this antagonism, real quick, because we've got about 10 seconds here, this antagonism that Trump has with Ryan and McConnell come to a head and they lose their jobs? as leaders?
Maybe.
Well, the Washington Post today has got some musings about Breitbart's Steve Bannon and some Freedom Caucus members thinking about trying to put Newt Gingrich back in the House speakership.
Oh boy, we will save that and talk about that when we return. In just a moment here on GPB, but first we are reminding you that it is your support that makes these discussions possible. Here's Ricky Bevington and Bert Wesley Huffman to tell you what you can do to support GPB. Welcome back to Political Rewind on GPB. I'm Bradley Georgian for Bill Nygut. Before we get back to the political discussion, we want to let you know that Governor Deal has expanded the state of emergency for counties that could be affected by Hurricane Irma. This is now to a total of 94 counties, and this includes, Jim, pretty much every county in South and South Central Georgia.
Yeah, I think if you drew a line from Muskogee County to Macon to Augusta,
yeah,
that you'd be pretty much hitting all of these counties.
And again, just looking at the statement from the governor's office, just reiterating that the contraflow and the mandatory evacuations east of I-95 are in effect starting at 8 a.m. tomorrow. Of course, GPB will have updates on the storm throughout the weekend on the radio and also at our website, gpbnews.org. So getting back to politics, Jim, I just opened up a story on the Washington Post website, and I feel like I fell down a rabbit hole and landed in a parallel world, because the headline is Gingrich or Santorum as Speaker. House conservatives plot mischief for the fall. What in the world is going on?
Well, here's something you might not have known. You don't have to be a member of Congress to be Speaker of the
this
House.
This is true, because I remember when I was working in Nashville, and the congressman for Nashville, Jim Cooper, conservative Democrat, cast his vote for House Speaker, I believe, one time as Colin Powell.
Right. And on the Freedom Caucus side, and Tamar can back me up, I think, at this, there's been a great deal of disappointment that Republicans, both in the House and the Senate, didn't have their game plan ready on January 21st, the day after Trump took office. They've balked when it comes to repealing Obamacare. Now they're getting rolled by Donald Trump on a debt ceiling bill. And they are just not a group of happy campers. And you've got Steve Bannon out there, who has defected from the White House and is now trying to reclaim the revolution from the chief revolutionary.
Exactly. And Breitbart has made a name for itself in the past of not being afraid to go against Republican leaders. They were the ones who really beat the drum against John Boehner. And so you can see them start to wind up a little bit against Paul Ryan. There's always been a little bit of a weariness there. People on the right about him, but I think there is a frustration that there aren't more wins in the, you know, for Republicans since they've got unified control of government.
So is this plan to get an outside conservative elected speaker? Is it really going to gain any traction among the GOP caucus in the House?
I'm not seeing a whole lot.
I wouldn't think so.
Putting a chair in it
makes a good headline.
Yeah, it does.
I wouldn't think so. And let us remember, Newt Gingrich left the speakership in
98.
And right now his only current official status is as the spouse of a U.S. ambassador to the Vatican to be.
Right. Gingrich.
Not official yet.
Not official yet.
So I'm thinking that one might subvert the other. So I wouldn't be surprised if Gingrich tries to step on this talk real quick.
And remember that Ryan is there for a reason, because there was nobody else who could get 218 Republican votes. That was a huge problem after Boehner stepped down. For weeks, there were names that would float up, including Lynn Westmoreland.
Right.
Put his name up. I know Tom Price had been interested, but there was nobody who the caucus could really unite behind, and Ryan was the closest thing. They kind of begged him to run. But if it's not Paul Ryan, then who can make the Freedom Caucus happy and also the Tuesday group, the moderates? I have no idea.
And I don't think it's not Kevin McCarthy.
No, it's not. He tried.
The majority leader.
Yeah, exactly. Everybody thought he was going to be the next speaker back in 2015 when Boehner stepped down, and that didn't end up working out. So I can't think of anybody.
And this also gets at Donald Trump's frustration. Again, he's not ideological. He's not absolutely convinced that you have to be a purist to govern. And that strikes at the heart of I think, Republican objections.
Of this frustration that Republicans kind of feel, I guess, you know, controlling White House, both houses of Congress, and yet still your agenda is just not getting any traction at all.
Exactly. And this is a thing that has characterized the GOP for years now, but they really are a very tribal kind of party. You have your moderates, you have your establishment Chamber of Commerce people, you have your ultra conservatives. It's really hard to find somebody to appeal to all of them. And that's something we've seen come up over and over again over the last few years. And I don't know how much Trump has helped. I think it has in the short term, but in the longer term, I think a lot of those same you know, divides are still there.
To Mark, did any Georgia Republican in the House support the debt deal today?
They actually have the vote totals here. Let's see. Excuse me, just a moment. Okay, so I'm just going to go down the list. This is from C-SPAN's website. Buddy Carter voted yes. Drew Ferguson, yes. Karen Handel, yes. Rob Woodall, yes. Austin Scott, yes. Doug Collins, no. Jody Heiss, no. Barry Loudermilk, no. Rick Allen, yes. Tom Graves, yes.
You know, the one in there that surprises me tomorrow is Doug Collins,
exactly,
who has been a rising member of the House leadership.
Exactly. Right. And that was interesting. But I was looking at the vote total for all of the Republicans, and there were some members of the leadership team who voted no. Perhaps, you know, an edict was given, you know, vote your conscience. But Loudermilk and Heiss were not as much of a surprise to me. They're the most conservative members of our delegation. And they had mentioned to me, Barry Loudermilk did, that that he didn't like that all of this was being bundled together. They had voted earlier in the week on a standalone Hurricane Harvey aid bill, and all of them supported it. But they're saying once it was coupled with the debt deal, once it was coupled with government funding, they were really uncomfortable with that.
And you mentioned, going back a little bit, Jim, you talked a little bit about Steve Bannon. He did an interview with Charlie Rose on CBS this week. It's going to air, I guess, on 60 Minutes this Sunday, and they've been teasing out little bits and pieces of it. What are some of the surprising things that we've heard from Bannon so far in that interview?
Oh my goodness, you're blindsiding me here.
Okay. Tamar, go ahead.
He said first of all that the right was angry at Donald Trump about DACA. He said, you know, he's a Catholic, but he criticized
the Catholic
Church and mm-hmm. said that they were supporting it because they wanted undocumented immigrants to fill the pews. And that they're using it as kind of a tool because, you know, people weren't as involved in the Catholic churches before. But a lot of these people from Central and South America are. It was a pretty amazing thing to hear.
And it comes out, just to that point, Bradley, an interesting fact came out today from one of the think tanks up north. I don't think it's D.C. based. I think they're based out of Pennsylvania, maybe Pennsylvania State. But right now, only 43% of the white Christians make up only 43% of the nation now.
Or those who identify as
Those who identify as white and Christian. That's down from something like 80, maybe only 20 years ago. And Tamar's right. In a way, Bannon is right that the Christianity in the United States is becoming less Protestant and browner, more Hispanic.
And we will have to leave that there because we have to take another break here to remind you that it is the Fall Fund Drive here at GPB, and here's how you can support us. Welcome back to Political Rewind. We're going to close out the show by talking a little bit about some local political matters relative to the Atlanta area. Jim, Amazon announced this week that it wants to build a second corporate headquarters, that it's growing so much and that its existing headquarters in Seattle is just so large and so sprawling that they need to build a second campus. And
they put the specs on their website. They're willing to spend $5 billion, and this place may eventually house 50,000 employees. Mm-hmm. This is the holy grail of economic development. And I think reading a Bloomberg report, I think Atlanta was one of maybe six cities that they judged would be eligible in terms of workforce, in terms of international airport access.
And there were other qualifications like access to transit and that type of thing.
Right,
but
right.
I mean, there are also all sorts of lists, of course, because everyone's looking at this. And, you know, a couple schools of thought. Number one, you know, places like Denver might have better transit options, among other things. And Chicago, you know, is in the mix, among other places. There's also, you know, the idea of what kind of tax incentives might be put into place, which, as you know, Jim,
that was going to be the question.
That's the Georgia strong point there.
What kind of backflips can we imagine that state officials, local officials would be doing to land something like this?
Well, the tax incentives, number one.
Right.
A very generous package, I would think. But to me, the thing, the win or lose this prize here, what the impact it has in my thinking is that it's really going to tamp down the culture wars in the state legislature come January. That if you are trying to lure Amazon from Seattle, you're not going to want to tolerate any fights over Confederate symbolism, and you're not going to want any fights over religious liberty. So I think you'll find Nathan Deal and the Republican leadership in the Capitol putting the General Assembly under some very strict discipline in that realm.
And a key part of that, of course, is a number of those leaders are also running, right?
Right.
So
exactly.
You have, you know, Lieutenant Governor Casey Cagle is running for governor, Secretary of State Brian Kemp. There are obviously a number of you know, senators. Hunter Hill is in the
mix. But at the same time, a lot of those Republican politicians, they are feeling the need to kind of burnish their conservative credentials. And one of the ways to do that is supporting one of these causes, right?
Right, 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 exactly. But it gets at the essential tension among Georgia Republicans. You have social conservatism, and that is really really important in a primary. But you also have business conservatism. And wouldn't you like to be known as, if you were Casey Cagle, as the fellow who brought Amazon to Georgia, or Hunter Hill, or who else have we got? Brian Kemp is kind of out of the loop there because he's Secretary of State Michael Williams.
Mm-hmm.
So that's a great temptation to hang out there for legislators, I think.
Well, and there would be certain considerations taken into place. Let's say there's some sort of you know, we can use the word token. Passage of something that says they support religious liberty or the idea of religious liberty,
can be done as well. Yeah, just to get it off the agenda. I mean, I would point you to the fact that, you know, we've had, what, four sessions of the General Assembly to deal with religious liberty issues, I think now. And it's passed the legislature once. The governor vetoed it. And the reason I think the one of the primary reasons that it has had such a tough time in a deeply red state is because you've got this alliance between the LGBT community with this very new and very, very lucrative movie and television industry that's popped up in Georgia. And one, that industry is not going to tolerate same-sex discrimination. And so this is kind of an outgrowth of that.
And that's also a business argument, right?
Absolutely.
That you want to continue that ranking that Georgia has. You want to continue welcoming those types of productions into the state. So it isn't, you know, for leaders, it's not saying, oh, we embrace same-sex marriage. It's saying we embrace good business.
No. It gets back to that old Mr. Rich, the story about Mr. Rich from Rich's department story. There's, you know, there's no black, there's no white, there's only green.
Tamara, anything you want to add to this?
No, it's interesting. I figured once Republicans took control of all levers of power here in D.C. that there would be more of a discussion about federal religious liberty here in Washington, but there really hasn't. I think a lot of people would rather have the Supreme Court deal with it, which is my understanding of what's happening. And it's been pretty quiet up here.
So the other local story I wanted to talk about real quick in the moments we have left, the Gwinnett County town of Snellville has had some issues with local government over the years. And this week, Mayor Tom Witz was indicted on 66 counts. Jim, what happened to poor Mr. Witz?
Without getting into passing judgment on him, I would say some
extremely
poor judgment. If the charges are borne out, I mean, spending campaign contributions for vacations, for a porn subscription, that doesn't I know this is not Republican and Democrat. I think like most cities in Georgia, this is a nonpartisan post. But still, that's not gonna play well, and I think we're in for a new a change of leadership,
and a change of government culture in Snellville, perhaps.
Well, look, this is part of Gwinnett County, you're absolutely right. That's always going to be we're in the middle of a big shift, whether it's the 7th district where Rob Woodall is facing some really heavy Democratic. Opposition to just the mere fact that you've got this House Transportation Transit Funding Commission holding a meeting September 15th up in Buford, up in Gwinnett.
Mm-hmm.
Gwinnett is the crucible of demographic change in Georgia, and I think Snellville is going to act on that.
All right. That's Jim Galloway from the Atlanta Journal-Constitution. Thanks for joining us. Christina Torres, thank you. Tamar Halliman, thank you as well. I'm Bradley George. Thank you for listening to Political Rewind. Stay safe this weekend, and we'll talk to you next week.